From the Sky News Centre at 6, a woman from East London has become the first person to be found guilty of female genital mutilation in the UK. She cut her three-year-old daughter in August 2017 and failed to silence her accusers using witchcraft. Inspector Alan Davis says it's a crime that often goes unreported.
It's difficult to get conviction for FGM because ultimately we're often reliant on a child to give evidence against somebody close to her, often her mum, that's caused the harm in the first place. People don't want to necessarily see their mum's prosecuted or go to prison for what they've done.
The woman could face 14 years in jail when she's sentenced next month. Britain's still shivering under a blanket of snow. Yellow Be Aware warnings are in place for much of England, Wales, Northern Scotland and Northern Ireland until tomorrow morning. The US says it's suspending its compliance with the Cold War Treaty and could formally withdraw in 6 months. It's accusing Russia of violating the agreement, banning ground-launched cruise missiles with a range of between 300 and 3,000 miles. Moscow says the Americans are trying to get out of their obligations. Ex-football manager Harry Redknapp is backing an anti-knife campaign after the death of a promising young player from one of his former clubs, QPR. 15-year-old Kyan Prince was fatally stabbed while trying to break up a fight outside his North London school in 2006. Harry says enough is enough.
We've got to do something about it. You know, every day we pick up the paper, there's innocent kids, there's kids we're getting stabbed. It's just an epidemic at the moment that we need to do something about.
He's supporting a campaign run by Kyan's father to help tackle the issue. Downing Street's called claims that Gibraltar's a colony of the British Crown completely unacceptable. The words surfaced in a document that allows UK nationals visa-free holidays post-Brexit. That's the latest. I'm Daisy Gray.
Back to basics.
BCFM.
It's Friday. It's 6 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, helping me review this week's news. Well, we've got quite a full studio today. It's Mel Sainsbury from the Labour Party, from the Lib Dems. It's
Andrew Varney, hello.
Also Kevin Carhill and
Kathy Wellham
from We Love Stoke Lodge. After the 7 o'clock news, martial law in the UK, is that possible post-Brexit? Or is that just the latest line that's being taken by Project Fear? Carried over from last week, the Magnitsky Act. US law, this is, the EU is about to pass, but is it just designed to stop Russia advocates speaking and doing business? Personal sanctions against anyone who supports Putin? Who was Sergei Magnitsky and his former boss, US financier Bill Browder? Browder, like some of the mafia's top oligarchs, fled Russia, or some would say were booted out after Putin came to power, accused of fraud. Plus, Ireland moves to implement boycott, divestment and sanctions on Israel. We go to the Israeli capital to hear from one of Netanyahu's cabinet ministers. Staying with Israel, actually, it's a Malaysia story this time, banned from hosting the Paralympics and accused of anti-Semitism. The Prime Minister doesn't want to give Israelis visas. Malaysia's Prime Minister, Dr. Mahathir Mohamad, explains why. That's all in the second hour. For the Comcast News at 7, calling itself the Sky News for some reason. I'm not sure why. Comcast is an American company. Sky. On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, snow, what's happening with it? Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast. Tonight, lows around minus one and dry. This weekend, highs around 5 degrees Celsius. Sunny spells tomorrow and icy overnight. Cloudy, though, on Sunday. So maybe it'll be melting by then. Next week, highs of 10 Celsius, a few sunny spells, plenty of showers. So make the most of the snow if you can. Tomorrow morning, I would imagine. Next weekend, that's the 9th and 10th of Feb, highs of 7 degrees Celsius, partly cloudy. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So was that winter? I'll ask you first, Mel Sainsbury. Is that it?
Well, it was melting today, wasn't it? I think it's going to ice over tonight. But I went over to St Andrew's Park with the dog today, and people just love the snow, and there were snow people, and there was sculptures, and there were sledges, and yes, if it's only one day, my goodness, we've had fun.
Kevin, what do you think? Is it just this one little bit of cold, and that's the red? Because it does seem to be very mild winter. I'm asking, for the last few weeks I've been asking people this, because it's been so mild, just a tiny little bit of snow.
Yeah, but remember last year, the cold bit's still in front of us, I suspect. End of February, beginning of March.
Okay, also, Andrew Varney, what do you think about the weather?
Well, it's very difficult to predict the weather in this country. I think that's the only certainty that we can apply here. But if we remember last year, we had the beast from the east and then the mini beast from the east. So I think there still could be a sting in the tail. There still could be some winter still to play out yet.
Cathy, am I allowed to ask you this question too?
Oh, you can. And we've been having a great time on Stoke Lodge, the whole community out there today with the kids making snowmen and igloos and doing the kinds of things that families and children have done on Stoke Lodge for 70 years without let or hindrance.
Now, it almost sounds like that was the sort of thing a lawyer might say, without let or hindrance. So let or hindrance has started to arrive at Stoke Lodge. Can you just take us through what's happening there? And I did see scenes of confrontation between Cottam School, people putting fences in, and some locals down there.
Yes, in the last few weeks it's kicked off. There's been this threat hanging over Stoke Lodge for years. The school has wanted to fence off the whole area, which is the last important green space in the area for the community to use. Now, in 2011, Cottam School, as a new academy, wanted a lease on this land, which had never required a lease before. Schools had used that land, and it had been used amicably with the community for years, many years, and suddenly, as an academy, they wanted a lease on this land. Now, the lease was issued. It was specially adapted to include a clause which protected all existing rights and use of the land, including by the community. The school is now, unfortunately, trying to rewrite that law, and unaccountably, Bristol City Council seem to be allowing them to do that. And that will mean that this precious green space, the last one in our area, and may I emphasise that Stoke Bishop is an area which has lower than the recommended minimum open space. And now they are trying to take this away from us by fencing it. They say the community may be allowed in through the gates, but there is no guarantee of that, and we don't actually believe that will be always
well,
the case.
Well, I'm sure I'm not the only one that's thinking, crikey, I didn't even know Stoke Lodge was there. Whereabouts is it so we can all make best use of it before a fence does fence us out?
Yes, come quick. It is at the bottom of Parry's Lane, just as Parry's Lane curves around towards Shirehampton Roundabout. And as you come down there, you see this beautiful, beautiful historic estate with scores of important protected trees. The original curtilage of a beautiful Victorian house, which is listed, and in planning law, the estate should not be divided from the house because it comes as one package. It's listed as one whole. And Bristol City Council and its planning officers and its experts on historic buildings have confirmed that status for that property right up until the beginning of last year or the middle of last year. They were still saying, right into the summer, I think I'm right in that any fence would have to have planning permission. And then in the last few months, suddenly, they have decided that this no longer applies. Somehow, the listed status of the estate has disappeared, and Cottam School are being allowed to split the house, which is now an adult education centre, from its land. So that 23 acres of public green space are being fenced off by a school, which says that they will only use it for about 12 hours a week.
Now, I did my best today to get someone from Cottam School down to join us. Without any luck, I'm afraid, I did actually manage to speak to someone called Penny Beeston, who's a mum from the school. She said that even though she runs a public relations company, Beeston Media, she's not actually doing public relations for Cottam School. She's just an interested person, an interested party, and she's running a Twitter account which is really supporting what the school are doing. What she's saying, effectively, is that this is just normal. Any land that's used by schools, you've just got to stop things like dog excrement on land, because you can't have the kids playing on a field where you've got dogs wandering around in the same area.
What I say to that
is I'm trying to be here for her, because she couldn't be here. I did ask her, but she couldn't.
It's a great pity that the school haven't sent anybody to speak. And I have to say that the head teacher, we've heard nothing from her since before Christmas.
But how do you answer people like Penny saying things like that? We just don't want dogs here. Simple
right.
as that.
Well, I would cite the Downs, where people play games and sports, and the Belgrave School, for instance, uses it as their main sports area. And there are 12 to 15 other schools. I would cite also Fairfield School, which has open community access on its lovely grounds in Muller Road, and has worked towards developing those grounds in partnership with the community to continue community use.
I've also asked someone called Sandra Fryer at Cottam School, who's their chief of finance. No reply from her, although it has to be said, it's very, very snowy today. And so the schools might have been in a bit of a panic, worrying about other things rather than what's going on down at Stoke Lodge. What about this argument, though? Basic argument. I mean, I know you've given some reason there. To disagree with it, but I mean, it's just, surely if they're going to be using it for school kids, they've got to be able to have some say, not maybe total say, over whether it's fenced or not.
Well, Bristol City Council in 2010 promised the community that that property would never be fenced. So there's a promise there, there's a commitment there. Yes, in writing, I believe.
You should be able to enforce that. Who's the freeholder? How did the...
Bristol City Council are the freeholder. Yes.
They are.
They are, yes. And they promised that this would be community land. In their local plan, they have listed it as important open space for leisure use and community use. And as far as the dogs go, the community is very responsible about their dog walking. And there has always, when I first went to Stoke Lodge in about 1995 with my children, I was told by the person who took us, and I'd never seen it before, and my mouth fell open because it is so absolutely achingly beautiful. The trees are amazing. The space is amazing. You take a deep breath when you walk in there and you feel that you're stripped back to who you are. And that kind of feeling is completely priceless. It's so rare in our cities, and to destroy that access for people to go there and enjoy that place is the kind of thing they talk about. It helps your internal health, your mental health, your emotional health, and obviously it gives the whole community access to a place where they can walk, they can exercise, and the community joins together.
I understand also there's been some rather nasty injury which you found out about by a Freedom of Information request with one of the fences down there with some of the children. So, you know, if the fence isn't just a fence, it also in certain instances can hurt, and I think, as I understand it, one of the children had their finger cut off.
Yes, this was at Coombe Dingle, which is the university facility that Cotham has used for years and years, whether or not they had access to Stoke Lodge, in fact. This was a 3-metre-high fence. I don't know much about this personally, but I've heard what you've all heard. And the child was sent to get a spare to get a ball that had gone over the fence and decided to climb over the fence to get back in. And she had a ring on her finger, and I don't suppose she should have had one on for that sports session, but she did. And as she climbed over the top, the ring caught on the fence, and it removed her her finger. I don't know how much of it.
Nasty. Well, anyway, fences can be problematic. Anyway, you want to say something, Kevin?
No, I was just wondering how, having made a commitment in writing, the council can be sneaking away from it.
Well, actually, I spoke to Councillor Chris Stevens earlier, who's a Green councillor, who's got a bit involved in this. He's not actually for that wall, but he's nearby. And he spoke at a planning meeting earlier this week, chaired by Sultan Khan, who he said, Sultan Khan, he thought the chair was trying to manoeuvre things so that this could not be discussed at that meeting. And he said he believed that the council were, or that the school and the people on the planning committee who were trying to make sure this wasn't discussed, were bringing the council into disrepute.
We think that too. I was at that meeting and I saw the two councillors, Chris Stevens. Yes, and and also we had Richard Eddy, and they were both speaking in opposition to the fence, in opposition to fencing the community out of this green space. And Bristol City Council, via their development control manager, Gary Collins, has not explained, and at this meeting, Gary Collins did not explain or justify in any way the reversal of all Bristol City Council's policies up to now in relation to Stoke Lodge. We cannot understand how this is being allowed to happen, and I would say I absolutely agree it is bringing Bristol City Council into considerable disrepute and Bristol into considerable disrepute, considering Bristol is trying to attract other people, organisations to come and live here. They need to have a consistent, clear policy, which is demanded of them, actually, in the rules of the behaviour of public organisations towards the general public.
Interesting. Do you think it's the thin end of the wedge here? You know, we hear about the gated developments in all directions, and now that the schools are academies, are they actually just sort of staking their borders here? And so, in actual fact, thin edge of the wedge, as we know, we've always shared all the facilities on the Downs and Baddocks Wood and all these different green spaces and places, and bearing in mind these are the lungs of our city, and isn't it the council's responsibility to ensure that there's always free access, like with the Downs? I mean, that's covered by it's the Downs Act, isn't it?
And the yes.
Free,
yes.
And,
the good old merchant venturers make sure that stays.
Yes. Didn't say that yes. It should be free access to all the citizens of Bristol.
Yes.
And it was in perpetuity, isn't it?
The point here is the mayor saying? The mayor, we now know, is in charge. Councillors have to take a bit of a back seat. What is the mayor
saying? Solomon, I believe. That's who he compared himself to at the last full council meeting. I think, in defence of the mayor, I think he's trying to sort of placate the two sides. I think it's such a pity that the school is so diametrically opposed to the local community. I think it's such a shame. You know, these two groups should be working together for that. They're in the same community, in the same space, and it's such a shame they have such opposing views. And the mayor is saying that he'd love to sort of bring the sides together to talk and compromise.
But I think in the old days, when these schools were controlled by the local authority, you wouldn't have to do that. You'd just say, take the fence down, and they'd do it. So this is, I suppose, maybe we'll just get a little bit from all of you about what you think of the whole academy school system. I mean, I've seen examples of some secondary schools where bits of playing fields are being built on by academies because they want to build little office blocks and places where they can run those commercially. But obviously then the kids can't use that playing field. Anyway, start with you, Mel.
Well, it's all about privatisation again and outsourcing, isn't it? And I have a friend whose daughter teaches out at Radstock, and she says that she's absolutely scandalised by the entrapment of the contracts and things that they have to adhere to. In her particular classroom, for instance, over the next 10 years, each of the blinds and windows have to be replaced, and each one will cost £8,000, and they can only go to them to have it done. So, you know, this kind of like this creeping up of all these things. But isn't it the deputy mayor Asha Craig. She's actually responsible for public spaces and parks, isn't she? And didn't we have a recent consultation about, because of the cuts, of course, about looking at, to privatise parks and to actually make them self-funding?
Mm. Well, I'm not sure who's going to cut the grass in the parks. And that's going to be a cost. So I think it's impossible to have the parks as sort of self-funding organisations. They did talk about putting billboards in parks. I mean, that would just be appalling, wouldn't it? It would just ruin that beautiful feeling you were talking about earlier, Cathy, about when you walk into a wonderful space and it's spiritually uplifting. If there were billboards everywhere, that would not be the case. But I do understand that isn't going to happen now.
No, it isn't. I mean, but the whole subliminal advertising thing, we don't want that.
No.
And also charging dog walkers was another one, wasn't it?
And park run and things like that.
Can't they just hire those fields out to farmers and then they can grow swedes and
we might
turnips,
have to if we can't get food imported, so...
I would love to see common land being grazed by livestock, actually. You know, down at on the sea walls, they've got the goats there, haven't they? And it's a very natural way of managing land, yes.
How can you play football if you've got sheep wandering around your...
Not on the cliffs. You can't play football on cliffs, can you, sir?
What about, no, I mean, I'm thinking about Stoke Lodge here, really.
Ah, right.
we can have sheep on there.
I think you can share spaces and places. Hmm. And if the school is only, you know, sort of going to be using it for 12 hours a week, then it's absolutely ridiculous in my mind, the idea that you would fence off. Because as soon as you start putting fences up, there's a famous poem that says, do fences make friends? And I actually think that borders and boundaries... They don't. They put up obstacles between people, don't they?
Yeah. Well, Donald Trump is a fan of walls and fences, I wouldn't want to.
I'm
be
sure if the school were here,
anything like him.
We ought to emphasise if the school were here, they would probably tell us there's some sort of legal reason why they've absolutely got to have this.
Well, I understand that Ofsted said that it wasn't necessary. I'm not sure if that's correct. Oh, I heard that on the grapevine.
Cathy, can you help us out with that one?
Ofsted did not say that a fence was necessary. They went out of their way to state that there was no statutory reason why this area should be fenced.
Yes. So, I suppose you'd be down there pretty much on and off permanently at the moment trying to stop this fence being built. Is that correct?
Well, that's right. And can I just say, though, that we really wish that these two communities were not at loggerheads over this. We would love the children of Cottam School to come back and be on the fields with us, and we have offered many times to access community funding in partnership with the school to build, for instance, a new pavilion, which at the moment they cannot use this land anyway because there is no usable pavilion there. So they're fencing in land
now,
which they probably won't be able
to use. I just heard a little cough there. Was that you, Richard Eddy?
It was.
Richard, the Conservative councillor on the line. The phone line worked, but I didn't hear from you, so I didn't even announce you. Richard, can you just give us some of your take? You're a Conservative councillor locally. Can you give us your take on what's happening down there?
By all means, I've been properly involved with Stoke Lodge for about 6 months, so obviously I'm not the ward councillor. I'm based in South Bristol, but I'm also the vice chairman of the DVC, that's Development Control Planning Committee B, and that dealt with the issue this Wednesday and also in December about the notices Cottam School erected last year, really seeking to bully local people. And we actually turned down one of those notices, believing it was illegal and utterly inappropriate. The fact, in my view, the council's utterly balked at actually taking a leading role and insisting that the legal and planning rules are adhered to is unacceptable. As Cathy said before, by rights, the school should put forward a planning application. But last December, the council officers actually went feeble on this and claimed they could actually use so-called permitted development rights to erect it. Now, that's an issue which I've sought to take up, as Clive Stevens did on Wednesday at the Planning Committee. And we have a chance, an opportunity to say that decision should be called in and the applicant, the school, should actually appeal and put forward the planning application. They've refused to do that. I would also say, regarding the trees, it's disgraceful. Many of the trees on this site are actually protected by tree preservation orders, and there are decreed national rules about how you deal with that. But again in December, the council refused to use the powers available to it. They said they take a discretionary approach with the school. So in fact, despite the fact the school, in my view, is damaging, even killing some of the trees by cutting at their roots, the council's sitting back and doing nothing.
Richard, so what powers does the planning committee have to actually pull them into line?
Well, one of your panel said before the mayor's role is limited. He's repeatedly said, it's not my decision. It's officers, planning officers dealing under delegated powers under the Planning or Development Control Committee. And that's just what Clive Stevens and I tried to do this Wednesday, to say it's a decision for us. We can actually make the score apply to us. It's quite unacceptable, the council's ditching the national and local rules here. And I would agree with Councillor Stevens. Sadly, I don't think the committee took the issue seriously. And Kath is completely right. In my experience, I've been a school governor in this city for 30 years. We've never had a case where a school like Cotton has gone to war with a surrounding area like the people of Stoke Bishop.
Richard Eddy, thanks very much for joining us. And Richard is the Conservative councillor for Bishopsworth. So I think we probably better draw a line under this now, Cathy. But I'll leave the last word to you. Just to remind you, the audience, that I asked directly campaigner Penny Beeston if she could come in and through her company, Beeston Media. I didn't get a reply. And I also spoke to Cotton School and asked for Sandra Fryer or anyone else to come in to give their point of view. I didn't get a reply from them either. Where do we go from here then? Are you going to be resisting this fence, and if so, how?
We are going to be resisting the fence. We are not going to go away. This is completely unjust. We want Cotton children back on that field. We want to be... We want to share the space. I cannot understand why Cotton regards our children, the children of our community, as less worthy of being able to enjoy this last green space, not having any green space in their immediate area, and not only the children, but a very mixed community with plenty of elderly, disabled and vulnerable adults, as well as the children, lots of families. And why Cotton has been so antagonistic and targeted us and tried to get us off this field so that they can have exclusive use to them, to the field, is anybody's guess. We cannot but think there must be a larger agenda behind that.
Of course,
we will be fighting it to the last minute.
Okay, right. Well, that's brilliant. Thank you, Cathy Wellham. I would just say also, Sandra Fryer or somebody from Cotton, please get off your fence, if I can say that. Come down and talk to people. Stop behaving like Starbucks. Stop behaving like Shell. You're not a big multinational. You've got human beings to deal with here, and I think you should at least make some sort of effort to get on with your neighbours. So thanks ever so much for joining us, Cathy.
Thank you.
We're also joined, as I said at the start, by Andrew Varney. Andrew, you've got some news today about the Liberal Democrats' mayor policy.
That's right. We've got a rather unusual policy, you might say, in that we want to get rid of the position of the elected mayor in Bristol. We have the right to referendum, although I must admit I'm not a huge fan of referenda, but we have...
Is that because people don't vote the way you
No, certainly not, but I think that direct democracy is not the best kind of democracy. I'm a fan of representative democracy.
We came into the European Union on a referendum.
Well,
we're
talking about the Bristol referendum this
year. I know,
but I would say that
you brought up the
but
EU
I
referendum.
Would say that if you begin a process with a referendum, then it's probably best and democratic to end that process with a referendum. So in 2012, we had a referendum in Bristol on the directly elected mayor. It was a very small turnout, and it was a very close result. I think it was something like 53% of the Bristol public said they wanted an elected mayor. But I think since then, it's been shown that it's been a disaster for Bristol in terms of local democracy. We've got a mayor who is in an ivory tower surrounded by overpaid executives and advisors, and the decision making that they're doing there is completely disconnected from the local communities
that
they're representing.
Is it? I mean, as we've just heard from Cathy here, Marvin Rees has offered to mediate in this dispute. He's not in an ivory tower. Unless they're inviting him up to his ivory tower, he's prepared to come down and speak to them.
Yeah, but what's happening is that local communities are feeling disempowered and disenfranchised. I think the principle here is that local people know what's best for their communities, and they should be empowered and have some say in that decision-making process.
I mean, isn't this actually a bit just like sour grapes? The Lib Dems used to run the city under the mayor system. They're not anymore. Labour have taken over, and you just want to go back to the old system because you won under that system.
It's not sour grapes. It's about democracy. It's about openness. It's about fairness. It's about accountability. And, you know, we've got a mayor who's making decisions that actually, in many cases, a majority of people don't want. If we just take the arena as an example, a huge majority of Bristolians wanted the arena on Arena Island. Most of the councillors, pretty much all the councillors and our local MPs also supported the idea of an arena in city centre. But the mayor, one person, made the decision against the wishes of most Bristolians.
Well, many Bristolians might want a spaceport here on the outskirts of Bristol, but we can't afford it. And this is basically Marvin's argument with the arena, was that this is putting public money at too much risk.
Yeah, but actually, if we look at the alternative plan, we're going to need to spend something like £100 million to provide transport infrastructure in order for that arena to get off the ground. So I think, you know, there are arguments of both sides, but I think the idea, the principle of having an arena in a city centre location is much better than having one on the periphery, where people are then forced to drive to that arena because there's no public transport.
So what's your timetable then to get a referendum and to actually finally get rid of the position of mayor?
Well, the timetable is basically 10 years from the first referendum. So this amendment was actually put in place by Barbara Jank, who used to be the head of Bristol Council and is now in the House of Lords. And she put an amendment when the directly elected bill was going through Parliament to say that after 10 years, the public, if they wanted to, could have a right for another referendum to review that decision. So that's basically what we're going to push for. So that referendum would take place in 2022.
I know you're going to tell me now that you're going to put a mayor candidate forward to stand to do that job, are you?
Yeah, so that's where it's kind of unusual that our candidate is going to be talking themselves out of a job. But it's the principle of, you know, the localism, and that local people should be empowered to make the decisions.
I mean, that actually is quite feasible, Mal, isn't it, for a mayor to do that? Any mayor, doesn't matter what party, could say, well, actually, although I've got all this power, I'm not going to keep it all to myself. I'm going to actually spread it around a little bit.
Well, it's a bit confusing for the public anyway, because we've got three mayors, haven't we? And I remember we got the Lord Mayor, and then there's the Metro Mayor. And I remember when we were campaigning for the Labour candidate, which was Leslie Mansell, which came within 2%, actually, of winning.
She did extremely well, didn't
yes,
she?
Yes, she did. But I know that on the doorstep, people were thinking, what's this, the sort of bus or something? The Metro Mayor is some sort of...
The Metro Bus Mayor.
Metro Bus Mayor, that's right. So, but, you know, our mayor at the moment, and it was very few people, really, that elected to have a mayor across the country, wasn't it? I mean, where's it?
Bristol was one of the only cities.
The turnout in
very
that
poor,
referendum was appalling. I can't remember the figures offhand.
And now we have a situation where Marvin has enormous powers, so he could actually quite easily overrule council decisions, or he can direct and decide that things aren't going to be discussed.
Well, for
and
example, it sounds to me from what we've heard tonight as if he could be intervening here and just saying, "Look, stop building that fence." example.
Exactly. He could if he wanted to. He does keep himself very sort of neutral on various things, doesn't he? So
anyway, what do you think of the whole mayor thing generally? You've seen it change a bit over the years since there was a whole system before where everyone had to sort of agree on something. The major difference between the two seems that you can get decisions done very quickly, whether they're right or wrong, is neither here nor there, it seems, with a mayor. But actually, to try and get consensus and try even get a majority when you've got, you know, three major parties in the city is quite difficult with councillors on their own.
Oh, it's an incredibly difficult job, isn't it? And I mean, I loved it when we had a mayor that was very ornamental, actually didn't have those powers. I loved it when we had, you know, the horses and carriages over at Ashton Court, and it was very much a sort of, you know, ritualistic sort of ornamental thing, wasn't it? But now we've got somebody who is, after all, just a human being, and he's as good as his advisers tell him to be, if you see what I mean. So therefore, you know, I don't like power centred in the hands of one person particularly. I want it to be a proper democratic voice. And bearing in mind we are such a huge city with such enormous influence, one of the good things that you can do in a position of prominence is actually to do that kind of networking so that we are seen to be, you know, a city that merits all sorts of enormous amounts of money being spent in it and attracting all the kinds of business that we want to bring here. So,
Kevin Carhill, you're a bit of an old hand at looking into these, you know, the way that central and regional politics has worked over the years. What do you make of putting all these powers in the hands of one person?
Well, democracy inevitably is inefficient, but the alternative assumption that autocracy works is not true. You know, you get apparent efficiencies, but you get a lot of very unhappy people. And you create a situation in which advisors and hidden, you know, lobbyists can get in and bend people's ears. That's a huge danger in Parliament. I mean, parties, I'm thinking of the Labour Party, get elected to government and then after 5 or 6 years, the things they said they'd do haven't been done. And you find it's because they were lobbied.
I think the Conservative Party is also guilty of that. it
defiles Parliament, the way the lobby system works.
I mean, isn't it simply the case that if somebody rich and powerful wants to get something done, they make a donation to a political party and off they go?
Well, look at the Brexit situation. And I will put it really simply. The people who financed it did so as a bet against the pound. And Theresa May is in a position to know who's betting against the pound because GCHQ log it. And she never tells any of us about this at all. But a lot of the people who gave her
that
party...
It's like some sort of insider dealing going on. Is that what you're saying? That you can bet on various stocks and shares and commodity prices going up and down?
Well, the Brexit proposition was bound to injure the pound. Just whether the referendum came out the way it did or it didn't, the pound fell because of the uncertainty. And all these...
Coming back to the unelected, unaccountable officers and the Bristol City Council officers, because they are unelected and unaccountable and they have quite high wages as well, these are the sort of civil servants, aren't they? And it was explained to me that what happens in a hierarchy of which... You know, the EU is actually run on the structure of local authorities, actually, where panels advise panels, etc., and you refer back to officers, etc. But what happens is that the further back you go, the more resistant to change these officers are, so the more conservative with a small c they are. So basically what happens is that, you know, this is not very democratic, is it? Because they don't want to tip the boat up. They want things to carry on like that because they've always carried on like that. And so, therefore, when we want radical change and we want to shake everything up, as you said, Kevin, you know, there's not enough time. You find at the end of your term of office, you've run out of time.
Yep. Okay, let's have a listen. You brought Brexit up. We've got to talk about it. I'm sorry. This is an exchange between Leader of the Opposition, Jeremy Corbyn, and Prime Minister Theresa May on Wednesday this week.
It really is time, Mr. Speaker, that the Prime Minister acknowledge she's got to move on from the red lines she's put down in the first place. And she doesn't acknowledge that in answers to my questions or indeed anybody else's. Mr. Speaker, our responsibility is to bring people together. Whether they vote... Mr. Speaker, we are the Houses of Parliament. We are the House of Commons. We do represent the entire country. And the point I'm making is we should bring people together whether they voted leave or remain. And indeed, I look forward to meeting the Prime Minister to discuss a solution that could, in my view, unite the country. Changes to the backstop alone will not be sufficient. Businesses and trade unions are very clear that any solution must involve a customs union and the strongest possible deal with a single market to avoid the damage of no deal. The Prime Minister may have possibly, temporarily united her party. But is she willing, Mr. Speaker, is...
Order, Mr. Ellis. You were at one time a barrister of one rank or another in the courts. There is no way that you would have been allowed to shout from a sedentary position in that way, and the judge would have ruled you out of order. I don't know whether that's why you stopped practising law and came into Parliament. Behave yourself, young man. You can do so much better when you try. Jeremy Corbyn.
Speaker, as I was saying before I was so rudely interrupted... The Prime Minister may have succeeded in temporarily uniting her very divided party. But, Mr. Speaker, is she willing to make compromises necessary that are more important, and that is to unite the country on a going forward to secure jobs and living standards right across the UK?
Prime Minister...
Can I say to the Right Honourable Gentleman, he's a fine one to talk about coming together when it was only last night that he agreed to actually meet me to talk about these issues. And he said, time and time again, he's told me to listen to the views of the House. He's just stood up and said, the backstop is not the only issue in the withdrawal agreement. Last night, the House voted by a majority to say that the issue that needed to be addressed was the backstop. So he needs to listen to the House and to recognise that. And his proposal last night, he put forward a proposal last night which referenced the customs union and the single market, and his proposal was rejected by this House. But I'll tell him what this government has been doing. Over the last week, we've been getting more teachers into schools. We've been ensuring we're giving more money to councils. We won a majority on Brexit. What did he manage? His Brexit plan was voted down. He opposed ending free movement, and he won't rule out a second referendum. He's no plan for Brexit, no good plan for our economy, and no plan for our country.
So that's Theresa May there talking to, or back at, Jeremy Corbyn, leader of the opposition. Mal, I mean, Jeremy's calling for unity, but he hasn't really been talking to Theresa May. I think a lot of people want to bang their two heads together and saying, look, just get a deal together, will you please?
Well, I've heard over the last week that Jeremy Corbyn has actually been behaving in a very statesman's-like way. And it was quite obvious by the winning of the amendment, wasn't it, that the no deal was out. He was quite right, because when he said there's no point in going in to talk unless that's off the table, and then all the other people went in and said it was pointless going in and talking because they were just, the red lines were set in concrete. So
I mean, this, what they're saying is what a lot of people are saying. In fact, if I can find it, I've got a clip of the former CBI boss Digby Jones talking about it, where you just simply cannot say we're not going to have any deal, because otherwise you're going to get a bad deal. Let's just have a little quick listen to that now.
In Newcastle, there's a businesswoman going to work. She owns her own business. She employs 20 people. She pays tax. She's got a house on the line. She is a typical business person in the United Kingdom. With great respect, not JLR or all the banks you just reeled off, but that is the core of British business. And what they've got is uncertainty. They've got lack of stability, and they cannot predict where they are. So what's the one thing they won't do is risk any more investment in their business till they know where they stand and they can touch the bottom of the pool they're swimming in. What is killing this is not Brexit. It is the uncertainty created by 650 people in the House of Commons who are fundamentally, as a political class, letting down the United Kingdom. It is not whether Brexit happens. It is the uncertainty that has been created by nothing happening.
This former CBI chair, Digby Jones, but he didn't talk about what I was going to say, but he's put another point there, which is probably similar, but ultimately, if you don't, I mean, this is the argument everyone is saying, Mal, is if you say we're not going to do a no deal, then all of a sudden you're much weakened in your position to bargain. The idea is you get somewhere between what they want and what you say is a no deal. And also, of course, there's this $39 billion that they're not going to get.
There was never going to be a bargaining with the EU. They operate by regulatory boards. You know, they'd already stated how much that they could give, and I loved seeing in the paper today that, you know, even if there's no deal, they still want the $39 billion.
Typical.
But, you know, in actual fact, all options on the table, I think, was the most sensible way to be approaching this.
But do you think ultimately it's going to be delayed? What do you think?
It's all going to plan, as far as my predictions were concerned.
Well, is no deal.
No, not at all. I thought about 18 months ago that we weren't going to leave the EU, actually, or if it was
what they call a no Brexit.
It was sort of, yeah, because I thought to myself, when Corbyn instigated the three-line whip to actually activate the Article 50, he had no choice but to do that, because it would have been political suicide not to. And immediately afterwards, that's when those six key points were drawn up about the protection of jobs and all those regulatory things. And I realised when I saw those, we didn't hear about them again for a long time, that they could never, ever be fulfilled by leaving the EU. And suddenly, quite recently, they've all come up again, and it's quite marvellous, isn't it? Because how, I mean, even just the time factor, there's no way that nearly 600 laws are going to be able to be passed for us to be able to leave at all. So I think the next thing...
It's going to be delayed, isn't it?
The regulations from Parliament. Let's hear
from you, Andrew Varney, from the Lib Dems.
Well, obviously, the Lib Dem position has been very clear on this from the very beginning, since the referendum 2016. We accept the fact that the country voted by a very slender majority to leave the European Union, but it didn't vote for a destination. And obviously, we agree that the Prime Minister should have the right to go to European Union and negotiate a deal, but then the public should have a say on that deal, you know, because no one knew what the deal was going to be back in 2016. Now we know what the deal looks like, and it's a disaster for this country, basically, and the public should be allowed to say whether they still want it or not.
What about people that say, well, we voted to leave, and if we can get a deal, that's nice, but we didn't vote for a deal, we voted to leave?
Well, I think, what did people actually vote for? It wasn't at all clear on the ballot paper.
It was very clear. It was in-out.
Really?
It was in-out referendum.
Okay, what about the single market? Because you don't have to be a member of the European Union to be in the single market. What about the customs union? You don't have to be a member of the European Union to be in the customs union. Theresa May came up with these arbitrary red lines that cause all sorts of problems. So basically, the withdrawal agreement is the best possible agreement she can get because of her own red lines.
So what do you think is going to happen? 29th of March, it's all going to be... We're going to stay? Or what?
Well, I certainly think that the whole process has to be delayed, simply from a parliamentary procedure point of view. We just haven't got time to get all the legislation through Parliament, so it has to be delayed.
EU would be quite happy to delay for a very short period of time.
But it has to be for a specific reason.
Yeah,
they
for
won't
a specific
delay.
Reason. But the problem now is that we've got the EU, the MEPs elections coming up, and of course all of our 23 seats have been withdrawn now. But if we're still in the EU and there's a delay, then obviously we're going to have to go through that procedure. And then they would be in place by July. So
I'm
we're talking about 3 months.
I'm glad you brought that up, because in those elections, who is going to be the new president of the European Union? And is he going to be elected? No, he's not going to be elected. He's going to be appointed. But if you look at the betting, it's on a particular German chap who I'd never heard of before. So I thought it would be good idea to have a listen to him. Who is this chap? His name's Manfred Weber. He's from Bavaria. And he is the favourite to take over as president of the EU in May. Who knows whether Britain will be... In fact, it won't be. Britain will not be voting for him, because nobody will be voting for him. But the people we vote for may be voting for him. So let's have a listen to him now.
And we have now a difficult political situation ahead of us. And we started with clear principles. For example, for me, the idea of the single market, and especially the idea of the freedom of movement, that the Europeans on this continent can freely decide where they want to live, is a great achievement of this European Union. And I will defend this principle, whatever the outcome of a British vote is and what will be. And we have other elements in mind. For example, the idea of avoiding a hard border in Northern Ireland, or the question of keeping the rights of the citizens strong and alive. And that's why I must say I don't see any room of manoeuvre. If the British friends want to have renegotiations, And if they have further requests to the negotiations, then we have also the right to ask for further questions. And then we open the whole box. Not only the British questions will be on the table if there would be any kind of renegotiation. So for me, there is at the moment no room of maneuver for any renegotiation. Then the final statement I want to make is, I'm traveling around Europe at the moment as a candidate like we all do. And I see nobody in the European Union who thinks that the British approach is a clever approach. Nobody is telling this to me. British people, the people in the European Union tell me more that they see political chaos, they see economic uncertainty in the British development. That's why our main message is in the election campaign ahead of us, don't follow the nationalists, don't follow the egoists, they are liars. It's much better to reform the European Union than to leave or even destroy the European Union.
Well, that's Manfred Weber. He's calling the people that voted for Brexit, the majority, egoists and liars, Kevin.
Yeah, well, a number of the... I mean, remember the 250 million a week, 350 million a week for the NHS. There were prominent and specific lies told by people like Boris Johnson for Brexit. Then there was all the fiddling with the hidden stuff through Facebook and Cambridge Analytica, for which fines were imposed today or yesterday. But as I say, what hasn't been analysed sufficiently are the financiers, the speculators, who put money into Brexit and who put money into the Tory party. The Tory party on this issue was bought for money.
But actually, this has been in the squabble going on in the Tory party and the
Labour
private
party,
actually, for the last 40, 45 years or so. Anyway, we've done
it. I hear an echo there that Corbyn has always said right from the beginning that you have to remain in the EU to reform it. And that's always been said, and that was the motion passed at conference.
But don't we see Cameron going backwards and forwards, May going backwards and forwards and getting nowhere? Mm.
Well, that's because of their own red lines. They put down these red lines about no customs union, no single market. You know, they've become a victim of their own circumstances,
yeah,
basically.
That was Theresa May. What she has shown herself to be, forget the politics, is the world's worst negotiator.
She'd be the only person to come out of DFS sofa shop paying full price for a sofa. She's just a totally incompetent negotiator.
But what I'm...
Listen, that's enough on Brexit, because we've got another
I must just say that the scandalous incompetence of the rounding up and registering 3.6 million of our EU citizens in this country. That's what. And didn't you say earlier on, Andrew, something about the fact the settled status that initially they were supposed to pay for? It's SS, isn't it? Does it actually remind you? Are there echoes after the Windrush scandal of something else here?
Well, we're going to now talk about some dispute that's been going on in the Labour Party, which is to do with the whole thing of gender identification and transgender. I don't know if, Mal, if you were at the meeting last Wednesday, were you?
Yes, I was,
okay,
yes.
Okay, great.
Yes.
So what we'll do is we'll hear from you and discuss the whole issue of this whole self-identifying transgender business after we've heard from someone else who was at the meeting, Matthew Strange, who said it was a... He thought the whole thing was like a kangaroo court. But anyway, let's have a listen to a little clip from him now.
This was a campaign, an orchestrated campaign with canvassing, filibustering a meeting to ensure that a result was a preconceived verdict, when ultimately, the canvassing, campaigning, activism should be against the Conservatives.
Yeah. Well, they'll say it's all democratic.
I mean, they can say that, but... So far as I can see, the meeting was anything but democratic. The chair in the meeting read out the objection, followed by the defence of both Pam and Esther, having categorically stated there'd be no cross-examination of either of the transcripts, to then go and personally support the objection and basically continue to utter the fact that he then had a conversation with the people that had made the objection and then validated it.
This decision was made without a debate?
Correct, yeah. Now, it just so happens that I was informed today that the chair of the LCF has resigned, citing stress. And I don't really wish for the local Labour. The Labour Party is very strong here in Bristol, you know, and that's the thing that I think maybe needs to be understood, where some of the front lines are. some of the philosophical debates that are happening in the party manifest in a geographical local area. And some of this stuff on identity politics versus class politics is really hot here in Bristol because of the historical legacy of class politics in Bristol. So we're really seeing a political and philosophical battle going on here that's really trying to tug at the heart of what the party stands for.
So do you think we'll see Pam or Esther as candidates in the future?
I hope so. But what will happen if they're not? And if anyone else who... Esther didn't even say that she supported what Pam said. She just said that she supported Pam. Anyone really should be supported when going through this type of situation where, you know, they're essentially facing justice. Even a murderer, you'd say even more so for a murderer, needs a fair trial. The most, we need to make sure that justice is actually really justice. So supporting someone doesn't necessarily mean that you agree with them. I remember Noam Chomsky on many occasions saying, look, I disagree with what they said, but unfortunately in a free society, being free means that you have to enable and allow people to say things you completely disagree with and in fact despise.
So there's Matthew Strange there. The issue is with a woman called Pam Beamish, who's a member of the Labour Party, and she was saying to a specific person, transgender person, that they were not a woman, you're a man. And although she didn't actually agree with it, Esther Giles supported Pam because she felt that she was being bullied online. And both of them, it's now been decided at this meeting, Mal, won't be able to stand as Labour candidates in future.
Well, I think they've got the right to appeal, and then it can be, you know, gone over by an independent source as well. But I think what happened at the meeting was a bit tense, to say the least. And I think what normally happens is that you have your selection of councillors, and it would be just a block vote, really. There are about 200 people there, and a lot of them would be sitting councillors. But of the new ones that put themselves forward, I'm sure with many, many qualities, and of course they wanted to be there, there had been certain things said on social media, and it is a very toxic space, and things can be taken out of context, and all these things can carry on. But there were things that were said on there that people, and a lot of people objected to, made the objections and made complaints. And there was a petition, as far as I understand it, that an MP had signed, and lots of, you know, executive officers, to say that, you know, these people, because of their particular views about the consultation on the Gender Recognition Act, you know, they weren't really, hadn't evolved into the situation, because we're still evolving all our own sort of ideas about how that will happen and impact on people.
The main point surely here is that people are entitled to have different views, and rather than to be told, well, your view is hate speech, and because it's hate speech, you're not allowed to stand as a Labour candidate. Which side of the fence are you on that?
Well, if you're a councillor, you need to be able to represent every single part of your area of responsibility. And I think what the doubts were there, it was a completely democratic process, and it was voted on, and the women will have the right to appeal, which I hope this isn't going to, have any effect on that. But the point is that if you have minorities that are going to come to you with problems, then obviously if you are absolutely, your point of view has actually gone into an area where it's not acceptable to have that because it's discriminatory, then obviously you're in a bit of deep waters there, aren't you?
What do you think about this? We've got a bit of a problem, it seems, in the Labour Party with identity politics. All this stuff to do with anti-Semitism as well as transgender.
I mean, I don't really follow internal Labour politics that much, but it just seems unfortunate they seem to keep having these problems with, as you say, identity politics, the anti-Semitism thing. I just don't understand it at all. It just seems crazy to me.
Let's just use as an example, if someone is criticising Israel and having a go at someone, who's supporting Israel, that shouldn't also be part of, you know, there should be an element of free speech in there. Yeah, anyway, ever so sorry.
Criticising Israel is not anti-Semitism. No. You know, you're just criticising a government.
Time now for the Murdoch News at 7. Actually, it's not Murdoch. Sorry, the Comcast News. We've just been hearing Labour activist Mel Sainsbury. I think you'll be back for 2 hours next week, Mel. Is that right?
Let's have a look and explore this a bit further, because a lot of people are very, very worried.
And we've also got
impact of
Kevin Cahill, who will be back after the news, and Andrew Varney, Richard Eddy, and Kathy.